Hi everyone, welcome to today's IT Showcase webinar, where we will be discussing deploying production workloads with Azure Resource Manager. I'm Lyle Dodge and I'll be your host. I'm a Senior Program Manager within Microsoft IT. We're partnering with the Microsoft IT Showcase team to talk to you about how Microsoft does IT. Today we have with us Pete Apple and Todd Robertson, who are both IT subject matter experts here at Microsoft. Before I ask Pete and Todd to introduce themselves, I want to remind you that you can use the Skype Q&A window to ask us questions at any time. Also, please use Microsoft Pulse at the bottom of your window to tell us a little bit about you. This will help us focus our discussion today. Okay, Pete and Todd, let's get started.
Hi, my name is Todd Robertson. I'm a Senior Program Manager in Cloud MS, which is part of MSIT. This last year, I've been doing a lot of work in Azure Resource Manager, or ARM, especially around template usage, so I'll show you some of that coming up. This is my very first webinar, so I can promise that it'll either be informative or we'll crash and burn, in which case it'll be entertaining. Either way, it should be fun. So that's a little intro on me.
And hi, I'm Pete Apple. I am the Principal Service Manager within Microsoft IT. I work in the Cloud MS Group, which is our hosting organization. So I work a lot with our application teams, our line of business teams, and I make sure that they have the right kind of resources for either on-premise workloads or for workloads up in the cloud, so using Azure and using the ability to work into moving things from on-premise and up into the cloud.
Great. Thanks, Pete. And so to kind of level set, when other enterprise shops or medium to large businesses are talking and watching this, when we say Cloud MS, so our organization is typically responsible and similar to other enterprise hosting groups. So our organization is collectively responsible for, you know, security, operations, patching across our private cloud footprints. So that may be some production data centers and some labs mm-hmm. environments that we work in conjunction with the product groups. And then also, we also do a lot around Azure. In particular, any of the funds that we spend on behalf of IT, we pay the bill, and so we obviously have a vested interest to go do optimization and other things on top of that.
All right, let me talk a little bit about some of that. So
yeah.
We've got a little bit about what we've covered today, already covered that, and so then let's jump into the agenda. So we're going to talk a little bit about Microsoft IT as a whole. I'll give a little bit of overview of that. Talk a little bit about the Azure service and how we've implemented over time, so you can have some ideas about where we've been before and where we're getting to. And then we'll jump into the Azure Resource Manager, and Todd will go into a lot of details about the templates and how we've rolled a bunch of that stuff out.
Awesome.
All right, so the Microsoft IT environment, just to give folks a little bit of a concept of how much scope that we handle. So we've got about 1,300, 1,400 applications, depending upon which week we're counting and how you count a service versus an application versus a microservice. And so there's a lot of flexibility in the sizing that we talk about. We've got a number of different devices, 180,000 folks in our AD that we have to track, either employees or vendors, and so we've got a fairly large scope to try and work through and trying to make sure that everything goes well. 513 sites now across the globe, anywhere from our Redmond campus, which is huge, all the way down to small virtual business offices that are out in various countries. Core infrastructure, which is part of our team, has about 50,000 servers. That's actually, I think, gone a little bit down from the 53,000 it was when we were talking earlier. So we've actually shrank that a bit with some of the work we've done with optimization and with the cloud work. And then we've got about 65 to 68% of that virtualized. So that's physical systems versus virtual systems. So we've had a really big push to move from physical boxes into virtual machines, either on-premise or up into the cloud. And so we've really tried to push that a lot. Now, if you look in the bottom right corner of this particular slide, we're trying to get to 90-95% up into Azure or as WAP, which is a Windows Azure Pack front end for a hybrid cloud in or on-premise. And so we're really trying to push folks into the modern way of doing design, modern way of hosting things up into the cloud. The other thing we're trying to make sure is that most of the line of business applications are moving up into the cloud as well. Finding ways to either move it up as a lift and shift or move it up as a re-engineering of the application. So when we talk about the organizational model, I like to have this slide because it really explains some of the ways that we've done our technology. Our team is essentially part of a larger Microsoft IT. It's about 16,000 folks. A lot of those are the line of business applications, finance, HR, legal, they have their particular applications. And then Todd and I and Lyle are part of a team that does the horizontal infrastructure, as it were. The security systems, the network, the edge, and then the hosting systems, how they build out applications, how they build out systems, how they build out VMs. So we make sure that they have all the right tools, all the right, you know, building blocks in order to put all that together in order to be able to run their applications day to day. And then if they have any kind of issues, they have any kind of problems, they come to us. As well, we publish out a lot of standards about how they should be putting things out, how they should secure it, how they should make sure that it doesn't break anything, both for compliance and then, you know, keep us out of jail.
Yeah, and I think a lot of those standards, you know, it's instead of classically we used to go publish those standards, a lot of times now we're finding that there are teams that are working on top of us and building on top of us, and they go, you know, lead the path and do a template that has, you know, let's say, integrated SQL always on using Key Vault encryption and,
sure,
and all these things, and they're kind of blazing the trail. And so we're in this perfect spot to say, since we're the central point and everybody's using us, that was an awesome template. Let's go take that and make sure it's been standardized a bit and maybe taken some of your application stuff off. But now we put that in our Git repo that you'll be talking about later.
Right. Sure.
And so everybody can use it.
And a lot of the time you have to realize that when you're trying to implement something into the cloud, you're taking a lot of the stuff you did on-prem, a lot of the standards, practices, the ways that you run an IT operation. You need to replicate that back up into the cloud. You can't just throw things up into there and hope for the best. It's out in the internet. You need to make sure that you are working very closely with your hosting team, your security team, your network team, and make sure that things that are put into the cloud are still secure, still compliant, and architected them from the get-go. You can have that compliance, you can have that protections built into there via the templates, via the right standards and practice already built into it. So you don't have to do it afterwards. You can have it just there from the get-go.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Yes. All right. So one of the things that we did when we were moving things up into the cloud was had an idea about how subscriptions would be managed. And so when you have an Azure subscription, you can actually go to the portal. You can get it through an EA if you've got an enterprise agreement. Internally, we have an internal portal where we get it. You get an Azure subscription, you start building out resources, you build out VMs, you build out PaaS resources, you build out web roles, whatever you want to do. We initially started doing this, a lot of focus on the IaaS aspect. We were having a lot of folks who were doing just VMs, wanted to move them into the cloud, doing a lift and shift. So it was a lot of work doing classic Azure. So this was with the standard original portal. It was Azure Service Management. It was a very simple co-admin model, right? You were either a co-admin or you weren't. If you were a co-admin, you could do most anything on the subscription. You could definitely get into trouble with that, depending upon who had access into the subscription, right? You could have folks who could tear down some, you know, storage and the like, or VNets, and so you had to be very careful about it. You had to make sure you had good patterns and practices, and so we set up a lot of that to enable that and actually put in some ways that we could protect folks from shooting themselves in the foot, right? That's the classic thing with IT. A lot of the problems, you know, when you talk about prod management and idle sense, are human generated, right? And so you want to make sure that you make people successful. And so that's part of what my team did, was to make sure that people would be successful. Now that we're moving out of the classic, we're moving now into the Azure Resource Manager, which is the new fabric that's available for the cloud. That enables folks to do things more by service line. So they're able to have stuff owned, the subscriptions owned by the particular service, by the particular app team. And then they're able to ensure that they have the right RBAC on there. They're able to make sure that they have the right roles and responsibilities, the people that have the right ability to change things that they need to change, and other things are protected.
Yeah. So for example, you know, if you're setting up an express route circuit, and you're obviously setting a connection back to your corporate network.
Sure.
Well, you don't let everybody go manipulate your express route circuit.
So no,
you place a resource lock on that and work with your networking people to get that established. But then, you know, if you let your devs go manipulate a bunch of other stuff because they want to do agile and very iterative development, but
sure,
you can ACL certain things around and make sure your database people can only touch those things and things like that.
Absolutely. And so when you talk about that, we've got two basic ways we're doing line of business these days. Express route, which is corp connected. So that's something that's actually got a tunnel back into our corp environment. It's something that's seen by other things that are on premise. It's essentially just part of the native corporate environment. It's actually still managed very much like the things that we still have in our data center. So we use the same system center environments, same operations manager, CM for patching.
Same DLP and security packages
absolutely
to make sure that
all
traffic
still available.
Initiated.
The other way that we're doing it now is we're having a lot of folks that are moving to straight internet. And so they're using Azure Resource Manager outside of the CorpNet. They're out in the environment for Azure. They're doing their protections and their code base out there where they can have the new modern way of doing development.
So these people are typically tying to Azure Active Directory right off the bat, using SQL Azure with Azure Active Directory authentication, and they're not even, they're thinking pure built and born in the cloud. They're not dealing with. And so some of these people, they're using the Azure Security Center. Mm-hmm. They're also using some of the OMS stuff that's out there.
Yes.
And so these people are really starting to think, hey, cloud first, and our identities, they may be on-prem, and our security groups may be on-prem, but they're replicated up to AAD, and let's just go build in the cloud today.
Well, and it's been very convenient using the AAD and have the integration back with our standard AD, because this folk can use the same security groups they've been using for years, right? They've already got those folks defined. They already know who is in there. They can manage it all within that same interface that they've been using, and then they can just apply that to these new resources, and they know who's got access, right? And I can talk a little bit about that. So that's actually one of the great things about Azure Resource Manager. We just have an overview here. This is essentially some of the stuff that had us embrace it, and I think what other enterprises will be really interested in using. It allows you to group things by resource, so you can have resource groups. Different resources can be then collected together based on applications, based upon who works on it and how they work on it, if it's dev test, and I have an example of that in the next slide. And then we can tag things. We can make sure that they're tagged according to who should own it, what environment it is, maybe some kind of financial thing that makes sense for the environment, and that's some of the stuff that we've done. And then enforce that stuff with policy, so you can enforce the tags to make sure that it's owned by the right people, or it's owned by someone at least, which is important for your CMDB, and be able to do showback, costback, the right kind of things you want to have within a real IT environment. And then we've been able to build templates, which Todd will talk about a bunch, in order to make sure that people build out stuff the right way and it has all the right sort of information associated to it. So, real benefits about manageability: they're declarative, they're dependent, and they're scalable, and it adds a lot of parallelism for us to be able to use it. Now,
what are a couple of things that we've implemented or tested out in policy? I know when I was talking to one of our upstream software development managers at one point, and they essentially said, "Hey, on my subscriptions for this thing that I'm building in the cloud native, they disallowed Classic."
Sure.
And so that they essentially they made it so that way when they're developing they had to use ARM and they had to use all the latest and greatest and they had to use all these constructs that VSO or Visual Studio Team Services can speak natively ARM deployments. And so that was one of the things that I know one of our partners did was to say, hey, don't let me go create legacy constructs in this subscription, so that way I am doing everything modern and born in the cloud. Have we looked at any other kind of policy things?
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about policy and how it relates to RBAC, because sometimes people get those a little bit twisted in their mind. So policy, what you're essentially doing is you're saying, okay, it's a resource, and I'm going to apply a particular policy on that resource type, and I can either apply that at the subscription level or I can put it at the resource group level itself. How that's a little bit different is when you talk about RBAC, that's what Pete was mentioning earlier.
Yes.
That's when you can control users with the access to a particular resource group or at the subscription level as well. So with policy, what we do a little bit more on the policy side for ExpressRoute connected subscriptions. So as a part of getting your ExpressRoute circuit provisions, you mentioned the lock already on the VNet, which is great. But we'll also do things like disallow public IPs. We'll disallow user-defined routes as well as network security groups. Basically stuff we don't want people poking holes in our network, especially because we have, I'm sure like a lot of the enterprise customer, we have assets in our corporate domain that we don't want to expose.
So by policy, you don't want somebody to go provision something in Azure and have a public endpoint that can now hit a machine that's virtually on our corporate network address space.
Sure, and as a primary service manager, I have a role to ensure the compliance, right? Our security teams define what are compliance standards, how you can get a hole poked into the network to allow a public IP, but you have to go through an exception process. You have to go and talk to them. Why are you doing this? Why are you going to create a tunnel for somebody to come in potentially into our corporate environment, and then give the okay for that?
Yeah.
And so we wanted to make sure when we were building out these resources and the way that we build out subscriptions that we would have the right protections in there and be able to enforce that with policy from the get-go.
And have an exception if you need to peel back a certain area, but at least
sure.
We're going to make ourselves secure by default, and then go take additional risk where we need to.
Yes. So this is an example of an Azure Resource Manager configuration. So this is what we might have, and this is an example for our finance team. And so this is essentially very similar to what the finance team implemented. So it's a line of business. They have a subscription in which they're doing Azure resources, they're doing Azure solutions, creating applications. And so when you look at here in RG1, RG2, RG3, those are resource groups within ARM. And so those are essentially a construct in which you then create resources to do your development, and then you do your UAT testing, right, user access testing, and then you have a production. And you notice in each of those, you have role-based access that you can put on the different resources. So you might have some particular folks who are in the dev team, and that's a dev owner. You might have people that are contributors where they'll be able to just contribute, but they won't be able to add other folks in. And then you have readers. They would just be able to see the resources, but they would not be able to change them. And so this gives us a much better ability to add people into a dev environment if they're the ones doing dev, but I don't necessarily want them touching production, right? I only want a certain smaller set of people who are able to access the production resource group and deploy stuff in there when it's time to deploy things into production on a regular cycle. Now, below that, you'll see the resource group that would be created for the express route. So this is somebody who's needing a connection back to corp, right? So they need to have the tunnel back to network in order to access other resources that are in our corporate environment. But that resource group is actually owned by my team, right? I am the only owner on that team. I don't allow the finance team to necessarily own that and change that, because that has all the network connections that go back. I don't want them to open up a network security group. I don't want them to definitely don't want them to open up a user-defined route and essentially, you know, like we said, create a hole in the environment. Yeah. I mean, that's asking for trouble for somebody to get into the environment. And so what we do when we typically create this is just create a /26, /27, /25, depending on how many IPs. We set it up. We put in the particular CorpNet or DMZ, depending on what they need. And then they let them go, and they can get IPs out of it because they're going to read access, but they can't change it.
That's nice.
Okay.
Okay, so our goal this last year was we needed to move everything to the cloud. And, you know, Lyle and Pete talked about how we're the centralized IT organization. We own the platform standards, infrastructure support, deployment, and then support for both. And then the lines of business own each application. Pete just showed you guys how that was laid out in the resource group model. So the question that we tried to answer is, how can central IT enable Azure Resource Manager adoption for efficient cloud and infrastructure management, which is a mouthful. So I'm going to talk about the three general migration options that people have done for existing applications. So this is it's not greenfield, it's brownfield scenarios.
Sure.
So the first one people look to do is if they want to do a no-code migration, they look at Azure Resource Manager using Azure Site Recovery. So with this one, the high-level usage is you'll take an existing application, you'll use ASR, it'll do a replica, a block-by-block replica up to ASR, and then when you're happy and comfortable with it, you'll do a failover, and then you'll delete that your existing on-premise machines or power down if they're physical. Mm-hmm. So what our role as central IT has been, you know, we do the scripts for clustering scenarios, because ASR looks just at a VM level. For the migration, we do assessment reports. So there are some requirements around, you know, can this particular server or application actually go? And we provide kind of the reports there. And then documentation, of course, to kind of give people a nice step-by-step use case. And then we do offer support as well if people get stuck along the way. So that's that one. The next migration option, this is a little bit cleaner. So if you guys have, I would say option one is if you've got a legacy application that's not well scripted out and that, you know, it's running fine, but you don't want to touch it. Option two is more, I've got everything scripted out. Maybe I've got continuous integration, continuous delivery set up. So I'm treating it more like a platform upgrade, in which case that's where we provide standard compliant Azure Resource Manager templates, and we expose them via the Azure portal as well as a Git repository. So this is nice because it's really almost two types of users. If they go through the portal, and this I'll show you some screenshots on, if they go through the portal, then you get the full native Azure UI experience with our standards applied, no code. You just have to put in the right parameters. If you're a little bit more in the DevOps model, then we provide access to the raw Git repository, and then that's where you can clone that repository. Once it's on your machine, then it's just, you know, files on your disk, and you can take it and you can modify it and you can change it and make it a part of your deployment process. And then the last one, which we're kind of in the pilot and consult phase, is containers hosted on Service Fabric. This is still pretty new. We're still piloting. We're still consulting. That's our role right now. The promise is we'll be able to do higher density and lower operations management. Right now, it's looking more like a front-end application components for now, with some minor code changes. The reason why number two is bolded, it's not a preference. It's just the ones we have screenshots coming up here.
Yeah. You'll be showing a lot of demos on, not demos, yeah, not screenshots. Demos,
screenshots, but yeah.
Talking through how we're using it.
So the nice thing about this is, when you look at it, the migration options from a service management standpoint, it's really about how mature is the application and how much can they tweak it, right? Mm.
Yeah.
The first option, it's basically, I might not even have the developers who worked on this code anymore.
It's a third-party app.
It's a third-party app.
The third party is no longer around, so
sure.
I need to keep it running, but I don't have the ability to go change your source code. Or, you know, a specific, you know, in like financial or regulatory or areas where they have third-party things that may be tied to older versions
sure.
of, this has to run on this version of Windows because it's a C++ app tied to this, and it just needs to run. You know, it's not necessarily the core of our business that's making us money, but it's got to run.
Yep.
That's a great scenario for this. It's the ability to lift and shift, keep running, and then as they do this, obviously they should do a few other things. They should probably right size it, because
mm-hmm.
yeah. they're typically going from a physical server or virtual server that's running on multiple generations older of underlying host hardware.
Absolutely.
And so,
yeah.
You know, when we've done some of these lift and shifts up to the cloud, do we typically see like a SKU or two change and test it out?
So what we typically see is folks want like for like. So that's what I've run into as a service manager. A lot of folks will say, well, I've had an 8-processor system on-premise. I want to have an 8-processor system in the cloud.
I want a 32-core, 64-gig RAM web server.
Exactly. But you actually take a look at the system running on-premise, and it's not actually that busy. And then when you move it up into the cloud, where all the processors are the newest stuff, the great thing about Azure is they're taking care of the hardware. It's the newest stuff that's available. We can immediately shrink that down. We can typically take an 8-processor and move it sometimes down to a 4 or even just to a 2-processor system, and it runs just fine, and those folks are happy. And it's a lot more efficient for us.
Yeah.
So it's a really nice story.
Oh, cool.
All right. Okay, so how this changes things. So as I mentioned, we're central IT. And our responsibility is we'll have a gold repository of ARM templates and some PowerShell in there as well. Line of business, they can self-service through the portal as well as the DevOps scenario. We talked a little bit about policies and standards, so we're still responsible for that. They're more like guardrails, though, and less like formal roadblocks that you can't get through. We talked a little bit about tags. Tags are really nice. They're just key-value pairs. You can tag on any resource or resource group. You can update them through the UI. You can update them via PowerShell. They're pretty easy to use, and they're pretty flexible. So if you have a need to group things and report on them or build additional processes on top for compliance, tags are pretty
usable. And I know you actually spent quite a bit of time with the tagging feature PM.
Yeah.
You could even do stuff like, I'm going to set a policy that if you're going to do a tag, it has to be one of these values.
Yeah, you can.
There's a little bit of logic that you can do
yeah.
with that, and
yeah,
so I
absolutely.
Think that helps some of these reporting scenarios. So it's not just I'm going to do a key value pair, and then you have hundreds or maybe thousands of people putting in whatever text string they want.
Yeah.
And then you have to go try and build BI and reporting on top of that.
Yeah, they introduced a new keyword. So when it first came out, tags were. Our policy was deny or allow, mm-hmm. and they released a new keyword called appends.
Mm-hmm.
So you can write a tag policy that'll go, hey, you know what, if you don't put a particular tag for your cost center, for example,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to put in a default value, so at least I can scan it and know.
And we put our CIO's cost center in there, right, so that way somebody goes and figures that out pretty quickly.
Yeah, there you go. I like that. It's not a bad way to drive behavior we want.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll take it as a feature.
Yeah.
So yeah, we do required tags, and ours is a lot around the CMDB scenario. And then application tags, like, you know, BP line of business can do their own application tags. Cost control is a big deal. The great thing about the cloud is that you can spin things up easily and dynamically, and it's elastic. The terrible thing about the cloud is people forget to turn it off if they're not paying the bill. So we see it as a shared responsibility around cost control. People need to be mindful around the application lifecycle. And then within the central IT, we do a lot of like reporting and then a little bit of tooling around to go clean up some stuff that clearly isn't in use. So.
And the Azure portal has a lot of this. You know, like for example, if you go to the Azure portal today and you're using SQL Azure, the resource blades will tell you if you're oversized.
Sure.
And tell you, hey, you could probably save some money here. And you know, we talk to that team all the time, and I wouldn't be surprised if down the road, you know, if somebody went and spun up an HD Insight cluster, you could probably get a notification like the next day.
Yeah.
Yep.
You haven't been using it. HD Insight clusters kind of cost a decent amount of money.
Yeah.
Or like some of the machine learning things, really powerful, but they are fairly expensive, and so they're working on that stuff, and so it'll be.
Nice thing about it. You can get some. If you were actually going to buy that and put it in your data center, I mean hundreds of thousands of dollars.
In months of procurement, and everybody knows exactly when it's coming online.
I can turn it on for 3 days, and then I can turn it back off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. I did my machine learning stuff I had to figure out, and then I just turned it back off again, and I spent a little bit of money. So it's really, really convenient.
And there's some stuff within the marketplace. Like if you guys search for like stop, start VM in the marketplace, you'll pull up some simple scripts that'll allow you to schedule VM start and stop time. Say you've got a dev environment and no one's going to work on it in the weekend. Okay, fine. Set up a schedule and turn off those VMs.
I think some of the folks have actually started to use some of the tags for some of that as well.
Yeah, people are using tags. Yeah.
Tying it together, right? Yeah. I'll put my downtime in a tag and then I know and I can go scan for that and then put it into some of the scripting.
Yeah, I see a lot of actually energy around this, and I see a lot of people working on the same cost, you know, similar sort of problems. And I think that a couple things. I think there'll be multiple solutions, and I also think that we'll see more come out in the Azure portal too around that scenario.
Yeah, I wouldn't. You know, I can't. Obviously, I'm not in the PG, so I can't.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have this ball, but
I
wouldn't be surprised if in the near future, you know, something popped in that said, "Hey, this is an ISVM. When do you want it to turn on and turn off?"
Sure. Right.
You know, it's a common scenario. And
and it's a trivial thing, but here's what I think is valuable. It's really easy to quantify business impact when there's real dollars associated with it. And you tell your management, I saved, you know, $200,000 or whatever the case is by just scheduling it. So, okay, the graph on the right. So Azure consumption options. So like Pete showed in the old model, line of business had very little control and very little responsibility. We actually had a custom application in front of the Azure subscriptions so that we could control kind of more granular access into it. Now, Azure Resource Manager came out. People are using the Azure portal and API natively. We lock it down through Azure Resource Locks and Policy and Security Center, and that's a nice solution that we can use natively. Line of business has a lot more responsibility, but you also get a lot more control. So,
okay.
It's good. All right, this is talking a little bit about how we did our ARM repository. So I'm going to start on the middle green bullet, so the Azure Resource Manager community backlog. So we essentially reached out to our BPU users, our service owners like Pete, our management, we got all the people in the room and said, what the heck do you want to do? Let's prioritize it. Let's get it into our backlog, and let's figure out what we want to do. Then we rolled out, then we'll create them. Then it passes through our security and cloud leads approval. They say it looks good. We have a beta branch as well that we released to start with, so we kind of go in a ring release type of design. So we'll release to the beta, make sure everyone's happy, make sure there's no bugs, and then we do a formal release into production. Now, when we do the pull request into production, how we built these templates is we built them in a modular fashion. So they call it modular, they call it linked, they call it nested, all means the same thing. It essentially means that each template is building on top of each other and referencing the underlying templates. So to give you an example, the very first one that we created was called Single VM. Just say, let's get a single VM express route domain joint. Next one we did is we said, okay, let's let's allow this to do multiple VMs, and we'll just iterate it based on the number, based on the value they put in. So we took multiple VM, which calls single VM, and really it's like 90% the same code. And it just kind of layers on top of each other, even into the more complicated scenarios, like now we're into clustering and SQL always on with a ton of standards around that configuration. So the reason why I mentioned this is that if you do a linked or nested template, it's going to have a public URI. It has to access a public URI. And the design pattern that people use is they publish it to the GitHub repositories. One thing we tripped over a lot to start with is paths. So in those templates, it's pretty easy to mess up not having your path pointing at, say, your beta branch, and you think you're testing master, and get into a lot of integration type of stuff. So we did spend a little bit of time within VSTF automating that actual string replacement, so that when you move the branch from beta into master, mm-hmm. it'll do that string replacement for you, and it'll publish out to GitHub for you. So that was very, very worth your time to invest in that. The other piece that we do, I mentioned, I think we talked about policy, and we talked about RBAC and a few things like that. The other thing we did with these templates is we enforce some of the standards through desired state configuration. And that's actually available through Azure Automation. So again, it's another kind of born in the cloud solution. So as part of each of these templates, the VMs will point back into DSC, so that in the pool model, so it'll be constantly checking get, set, test, basically, against your configurations that are set in DSC. Now what this allows, and I mentioned a little bit up front, is people use it through the portal, and you know, I'll show you a screenshot. People can do it through PowerShell. You can do it through Visual Studio. You can do it through release for VSTF, Azure Automation, Dev Test Labs, other third-party frameworks. There's a lot of different ways, once you expose it, that people can consume it.
That was really convenient, because there's different teams that are at different levels of maturity. Some folks have been doing, you know, monthly releases or daily releases, depending on their code level, and so they just want to work in Visual Studio all the time.
I'm a coder. We're a PowerShell team.
Yeah, I'm a PowerShell team. I want to do it this way. Or I'm new to this, and I just want to use the portal. I want some nice GUI, you know, none of that code stuff. And so it's been really convenient to be able to have all of these all work from the same template.
Yeah, and it cuts down on our dev cycles, too, because we can publish it one time, and we just expose it in a different way, and people can take it and modify it. So it's been good.
So you mentioned the repository. So essentially, you've got
repositories.
there's this public repository that is GitHub.com.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the Azure one. So we build off of those into.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a few different repositories. So internally, what IT is, you know, working on this is maybe 5 or 10 people. Hmm. But the people who are part of the security group that consume the templates is over 400. So there's a lot of people in the community.
And so this is like our internal Git. This is actually Git sitting on VSTS.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. So, to go over a little bit more detail on it. So, we have Git on VSTF. Okay, and then that'll actually publish out a clone of that into GitHub as well.
Okay.
On demand. Now the repositories. I'll say there's generally three repositories. There's the gold repository, which is the ones I just mentioned, signed off, approved, supported. If it breaks, we'll fix it. You know, that whole setup. And like I was mentioning, the people developing in the gold repository, 5 or 10 people. In the community, but it's exposed to over 400 users. In the community repository, we thought, you know, we're crazy to have that bottleneck. If it's just these 5 or 10 people and 400 people are waiting, that blows up this model and notion of self-service, native access to the Azure portal. That's crazy. So we said, all right, let's have this community repository. If you've got a project that you're working on, we're not going to publish it externally. We'll keep it internal because, you know, we don't want to go line by line to verify there's no PII data. We'll go, okay, publish it here and treat it like an example. So if you're working on this solution and you've already got it done, then share with other people. And then that's actually been super beneficial for us. SQL Always On, that was in the community repository first. So we got a lot of, you know, we're able to modify that code and reduce our dev cycles as well. Yeah. So it's almost kind of going both ways. The community contributes to us. We're able to make it into the gold repository. It's in the gold repository. People pick from there and then modify for their own application. So it's good. We should keep doing that. Oh, and the line of business specific, that's where people take a copy and build their own. So that's the general high-level repository overview. Okay, here's a few screenshots to give you an idea about what I mean when we deploy through the Azure portal. So this is a feature, so if you browse in the Azure portal and you just type in templates, this is the view you'll see. And actually, when you see it, you won't see all these templates because these are just controlled by our RBAC security group. So how we expose our templates is we take the templates that I mentioned in the Git repository. And I also mentioned that once they're in the Git repository, they get published out to GitHub. So there's things in these templates parameters that you probably don't want to put on GitHub. For example, the DSC poll server URL with the key. You know, it's fine to have the parameter, but if you've got the value in there, that's not good. It's going to be it's going to get woken up. So this one allows us to control things like that. So it's the exact same code, but we do default some parameters to internal so that people don't have that. There's less mistakes on parameter entry. It's just like security groups. People have used security groups for as long as I've been in the industry. So it's a security group. People join the security group. Replication happens. And now you can see it across all your subscriptions within the portal. And so that's what you're seeing here on this next one. Number one, it spans across all your subscriptions, which is awesome. It's really nice to have that. And you get that for free right out of the portal. The pre-configured parameters, there's a couple pointed right there. And then you can also hover over, and in your description, it's the description field in your JSON. That'll actually be exposed via the portal. So we're trying to kind of, you shouldn't have to leave the portal. You should just be able to use it.
You don't have to go to another site you're reading a document to tell you how to do it.
Exactly. It should be good UI. You should be able to do it all on your own. Yeah.
Absolutely. So the nice thing about this, we've been able to define it for our environment, right? Adding in the different fields we want people to fill in, where you want to be, the name of where you want to be, but also stuff that we want so that we can stick it into the CMDB, right? To be able to track it. Which app are you associated to?
And maybe the description will have the URL of the app to go get the app ID instead of them having to guess or go start to ask people.
Exactly.
Yeah. You guys got it. Okay, so that's the UI kind of version. So I said I'd do the UI, and I'd say, a lot of people in the UI, and then let's talk a little bit more if you want to do the automated approach. It's Microsoft, right? So we use Visual Studio Team Foundation Server as our standard. This has gotten easier within the last month or two. I don't know when exactly it came out, but the first time I set it up, this register of the SPN on the selected subscription was not this easy, but it's very easy now. So you go into VSTF. SPN is service principal name. So you need to authenticate to your subscription. This is the context it runs under when you actually do this deployment. So first thing you do is you put in your connection name, and it'll go and create the SPN on your target subscription that you're going to deploy to.
Mm-hmm. So this is good. The SPN is kind of an identity that has you're granting access, and then it's got to keep, it can go run on behalf of things instead of us going and putting in service account usernames and passwords and silly stuff like that.
Well, and the nice thing about it is service principal has really improved things for us in the Azure Resource Manager model, right? When we had the previous fabric, you just basically had cert, right? You had a certificate, and your certificate gave you all or nothing access,
right?
Now with the service principal, you can actually have the RBAC role associated to the service principal. You can have a service principal that's an owner, contributor, or even just a reader. So I actually have service principals that we put into the subscriptions for our BI where they just have read access. And all they're doing is just pull the data, right? But they can't change
it. They can see a lot of stuff in the subscriptions, but they can't do anything.
They can't change it. And so the ability to have that level of detail on the service principal is a really, really convenient thing, and it enables folks to be able to modify this and then yank it if I don't want them to have access to it anymore. You just pull out the service principal and it's gone.
Yeah. I'll add one other thing to service principal. The analogy I'll give is so your user, that's you, and that's how you authenticate to the subscription. Mm-hmm. Service principal, that's how application does it. So it's the same, very similar concept, just kind of drawing that analogy out.
Absolutely.
All right, so after you've done your SPN, now that's how we do the access. Next thing you'll need to do is create a build definition. So VSTF has to be able to find the files within the build definition so it can actually deploy it. So this is where I mentioned how you clone our repo and you copy it. So you'd copy this, you'd create your build definition so that when you do the build, those files are available for a release. I hope all that jives with everybody.
But, yep.
Okay. So then next thing you do is you create a release definition. And then here's where you can do a built-in task to do your resource deployment. You can specify your parameters in here. So you got your template and your template parameters. So you can do a template and template parameters file. Now, let's talk about not putting credentials in your template parameters file that you need. So let's say, which is a pretty common scenario, you've got a certificate key or you've got a password for your service account. Don't put that in your parameters file because that'll be clear text. That'll be in a repository that's probably not locked down. Be careful with that. But what you can do is you can do variables within VSTF, and in there, those are encrypted, they're secure, you can't see the values. That's the good approach to take to that. And then you can deploy this as part of your release. So you can. So now you've got your definition, now you can do your release, which is like an instance of that definition. So you can schedule it, you can do it on demand, you can do a lot of things with it. It's pretty powerful. So those are the high-level steps for how you would do it, doing a CI/CD from VSTF. I do urge you to kind of go through the documentation. I'm just giving you the general flow of it, but you'll probably have to run through the documentation in a few videos the first time you do it.
So when you talk about schedule versus the other, so we're talking about folks who are able to schedule out a quarterly release, a monthly release, a daily release, and just set it up as a schedule.
Yeah, you got it.
Perfect.
Yeah, I think that'd be very good. So then I guess we're up to lessons learned. We'll do what went well first. We'll start out positive. So we did early community engagement. The very first subscription that we had our RBAC model worked out on, we invited all our BPUs and we called it our sandbox, and we got people actually using it so they had skin in the game. We conducted workshops as well. So this is, again, where we got everybody in a room, and we did the initial deployments, and we just walked around and had 5 or 10 people helping, and it got hands-on with it straight away. And got the heck out of email and in person. It's good.
And I think one of the key learnings that we had along this when we started down the ARM journey is we made sure that our network person, our security person, our operations, our developers, and everybody else, we were in the same room working together to figure this stuff out. Because especially when we're starting to switch over to ARM or anything new, anything cloud related, developing, this is kind of one of those things where developing in a vacuum can really hurt you.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
So, when we started doing this, we said, hey, let's figure out, how do we do this ARM template for a deployment of a VM into Azure? And let's make sure that when we're figuring this out, the security people are figuring out at the same time, how do they put required security things in there? Or if people are using Key Vault in ARM,
sure.
How do we figure out how to escrow the key so then, somebody doesn't lose the key to a production thing and then it's gone? And so I think that's been really key for us is that we're that we developed this together and we learned together. And I thought that was one of the big learnings that we had is just when we're going this journey, make sure you have your security network operations, your sysadmins,
sure.
Your developers, the software engineering architects.
Yeah.
Well, figure it out together.
One of the interesting things as a service manager and talking to, I work closely with the security team all the time, and especially for stuff that's on-prem and some of the stuff that was early in the cloud, there was a lot of reactive security. Right? It was, I detect something after it's opened, I detect that they don't have anti-malware, software on their system, you should go fix that, or they don't have the right registry keys that we say are appropriate, and we're detecting all that afterwards. And then we've got this long tail of waiting for people to fix. You're out of compliance. 87% of your VMs are good, but the other 13% you need to fix.
Yeah.
As soon as we started talking to them about Azure Resource Manager and the fact that it had policy that you can apply and tags that you can enforce and a desired state configuration where you can actually have the reg keys detected and set just automatically. They don't have to worry about waiting for someone to go and fix it. It's just fixed.
And this, this makes a developer's life easier because then you're not going to the developer saying, you need to learn all this security and networking stuff.
It's just taken care of for them. So the security guys were at first a little bit hesitant, something new, I don't know about it, but as soon as we started talking about enforcement, stuff that's proactive versus reactive, there was a lot more embracing. And they were taking a lot of the standards they'd had for years and figuring out, how can I put this into this new framework and have it just be taken care of from then on? We've now started to take the DSC environment, the desired state, and put it back onto our on-prem now. So we're starting to have the Azure automation, the OMS, mm-hmm. that it comes out of, start to remediate systems that are on-prem, VMs that are on-prem, and keep them in compliance as well. And so it's gone true hybrid. It's gone not just in Azure, but it's now back into our on-premise
environment. So we've kind of said, you know, at first when we first started, we looked at, hey, how do we just start to replicate some of our stuff that we used to do on-prem? Let's replicate those ways in the cloud.
Sure.
And then we started to do this ARM thing, and we started to figure out, hey, what are our business requirements? Mm-hmm. You know, what's our compliance and other business requirements for scalability? And then let's figure out how to do those in the cloud. And then we're starting to see, we're taking some of the things that we've done differently into the cloud.
Sure.
And we're bringing them back to on-premise. And I think that's kind of it's a full circle of, hey, we took stuff to the cloud, and now we're taking stuff from the cloud back to our on-premise environments.
Sure. Yeah. So maybe you can talk a little bit about our initial work going the PowerShell route versus...
Oh, you want to jump to what we do differently?
Yeah, a little bit. I think that would be good for folks to understand.
For folks to understand, we still have some ASM around.
Oh, absolutely.
We still have that first Azure Fabric, you know, and so how do we, if you can kind of weave in, you know, how do we manage both of those environments?
Sure.
It's probably good to reflect back and consider how we do it better. Yeah, so the very first thing I mentioned, we were in the sandbox. The very first thing we deployed is we said, all right, let's get V1 out the door. Let's make it easy on us. I'm going to write a PowerShell module because I like PowerShell. These guys are going to import the module. They're going to have a little bit of help on the parameters. Boom, away you go. And then after many, many support calls, I thought we realized that we were spending all our time troubleshooting client issues. Well, you have to have the latest version of the Azure PowerShell module installed. Hey, you need to have set execution policy set to unrestricted. You know, you just run into all these particular client issues around different OSs and different versions, and it really, if you have to teach someone who's not familiar at the command line or PowerShell how to use it, it's going to be really difficult at scale to do. So that's one thing that when we started sharing through the portal natively and gave that kind of no-code solution, our support calls went, like, it decreased dramatically. Yeah. You know, down
people
by,
are using
down
the native portal that they're used to, and it's
It's all set to go. So that was a huge learning for us. The other learning for us too was, less dogmatic. We started out very dogmatic about everything needs to be a DSC script extension for our configurations. It's a great framework, but it's not as fast as if you do the custom script. So I think that was the other takeaway. I think I would have started more with custom script and then just chunked and done the migration a little bit at a time to the end state. So I think those are the two big ones we kind of took away. And back to, you know, the portal versus command line, where we draw the support line, and this is kind of the demarcation between central IT and line of business, is we say, all right, if it's within the portal, no problem. We'll support that. It's pretty easy to train up your tier one team on how to make sure people put in the right parameters. If people want to jump into the command line and some of the other ways to deploy it, then that's on the line of business. And I think that's appropriate too, because they're the ones who want to get into that model. They're going to have to support it. They're going to have to rev it. One thing I forgot to mention, but I will mention now, is when you do the nested ARM templates, make your line of business take a snapshot of it. So I mentioned we've got over 400 people that consume these templates. There's no way we can keep track of who's doing what release and when, and parameters will change. Mm-hmm. So if you're going through your application lifecycle and you're going through, you know, your dev, test, UAP production environment or something equivalent, you want to be on the same version all the way through. So the guidance we kind of give there is, take a snapshot of the templates, but update the nested to be hosted on your own blob storage so that you're able to have that snapshot in time and then kind of treat it almost like a platform upgrade. So your next platform upgrade rolls around, cool, I'll take another snapshot from the gold repo, I'll grab it, I'll update it, I'll host it, and then you won't run into any integration problems down the road.
And I think it's kind of key here to you know, a lot of our customers ask, you know, who owns the applications in Microsoft?
Yeah.
And so, you know, because there are, when we talk to customers, I've talked to some customers where the application team, the line of business team, owns absolutely everything. In other shops, you know, the IT hosting and the operations team
sure.
owns the application completely end to end. So for here, our line of business application teams that are building services, they're ultimately responsible for the quality delivery, uptime of that application, and then they turn around and hold us running their infrastructure to an SLA.
Sure.
And so I think this is kind of key that the actual application development is done in those line of business teams, and then they hold us accountable to SLAs just like they would hold any other hosting provider.
Well, the nice thing about the way that we've done this is it really does scale, right? We've had to scale. You know, we're a huge organization. We're out of their way. We've created this community. We've created these templates. These folks can use them. They can build out their stuff. We enabled them. We get out of their way. If you're more of a smaller organization, a smaller IT shop where you're doing most of the work and you're holding the app, you're opening everything soup to nuts, right?
Yeah.
All the way from the infrastructure all the way up to the apps. You run the whole thing. You can still set up the GitHub. Your internal teams can use it, and then you can iterate it as me. And you just don't open it up to the app folks, right? They don't want to do development. They just want to run the app that you provide to them. And so that really is the nice flexibility about this is that you can have that available for folks who do want it, and for other ones, you can just still run it centrally and have it all in there for yourself.
Yep.
Yeah, great. The other ones on the list, I think I pretty much covered. Yeah, make sure you do the good documentation on the usage for your descriptions on each parameter. That'll cut down. I'd say about 80% of our support issues that come in right now is bad parameters. So make sure you do good documentation around that, and it'll make life easier. Also, use drop downs too where you can. Yeah.
So how did our team when we first started doing this? You know, using VSTS and in integration with VSTS and auto deploy and in creating those creating those template files that in the native portal pulled the description and showed that. I mean, what are a couple of keywords that people can bang on to get started with that, you know, to get them started with how do I do templates in the enterprise so that people can deploy? Is that, you know, right on Azure.com under templates? I mean.
There's a few on the documentation on MSDN that'll tell you all the different schema for the JSON. Generally, for the drop-down, you're going to use allowed values, and then that's your kind of drop-down one. The one thing to note is if you have allowed values, you can't go in and manually override it, so that's just that kind of gotcha. And that's probably the main one we use for the drop-down. So you can also have a default value, and that's a single one.
The best thing is that a lot of this stuff is already published out in GitHub. Azure itself has a ton of templates already published, so people can just go and grab it. I mean, you're not writing JSON from scratch, right? You can go take other people's things, see what makes sense, modify it for your environment, and then publish it within your own template, and you're done.
Yeah, all the Azure templates are hosted on GitHub, and then you can also go to github.com/microsoft and see a bunch of the other product groups that are deploying. A bunch of stuff around this on there.
Then all you have to worry about is your environment, which domains is appropriate for your, right? You can change it for your stuff, and you're ready to go.
Yeah, I agree with Pete. That's a great call. You should start up on the Azure Quick Start templates.
Right.
I think a good chunk of the time you're going to find almost exactly what you're looking for. And then, you know, take that down, throw it into Visual Studio, and then Visual Studio's got a lot of IntelliSense and help, and you can even drop in other resources for not all resource types, but certain resource types you can drop in. So it's an easy way to kind of author.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's
it. So we've got some Q&A, but actually I've been looking through the Q&A, so these questions that I've been asking in the last few minutes have actually been from our Q&A. So if you can, if you're on the webcast right now, if you have any other questions, please let us know in the next few minutes. Thanks Pete and Todd for your time today. We hope this session has been valuable to everyone online. Several of you have submitted some great questions that I think we just got through, specifically around I think and a lot of the questions that I get from enterprises that we talk to are, this Azure stuff is really cool. I'm excited. How do I get started?
Sure.
And so, you know, when somebody asks that, how do you How do you typically tell them, how do I get started doing this Azure thing in the enterprise?
Yeah, Quick Start Templates. Go to the Azure Quick Start Templates. You can even click on the Azure Deploy.json within the Quick Start Templates, and that will launch the portal view within your Azure subscription. And then from there, your parameters will be filled out, but you're in a GUI, you haven't even had to touch code yet, and you can start deploying some more, a simple scenario all the way to a complex scenario.
The other thing to make sure is folks should go and look at the RBAC roles that are already predefined within Azure. There's a lot of information in TechNet and in MSDN about, the different folks that can be configured as a full owner or a SQL DB or a VM owner or a VM administrator. Just read access. Understanding all those and then starting to map those into what is already configured for your environment, all right? I've got the team that's the SQL DBAs. All right, those guys map to this RBAC role. I need to just figure out how I assign that in my subscriptions and then also assign that for resources that are getting created within the templates, right? I'm going to build out a VM that is going to be run in SQL. All right, those guys, SQL DBAs, they get assigned to that, and you just figure it out from what you've already got defined in your present environment. It's not that you're recreating a lot of stuff. Yep. Your security group should be able to be brought over with AAD. Yep. Just have the same people doing the same work.
And I think it's funny, even roles and skills. I've also heard people say, hey, we're migrating to Azure. Like, what does that mean for my DBAs? And it's like, they still need to do DBA work.
Yeah, they still need to log into the DB.
They still need to be making sure that people are designing things correctly. Those people just now have additional enhanced tools.
Absolutely.
They can do... Yeah. more powerful things in the cloud than they could do on-prem. So I think that's a big thing that I tell customers is, hey, your really good people are still going to be doing really good things. They'll be able to do more.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of key.
And when you're testing out your RBAC permissions, I recommend you'll probably be an owner or contributor at the subscription level. It's user access admin. An owner or user access admin to configure it at the subscription level. But then have your friend or a service account be the least privileges model, and then test your scenario like that so you don't run into some...
It works on my machine. Why didn't it work on your machine?
Exactly.
Okay. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think we're now at the end of our broadcast. I want to thank you guys both for taking the time out of your day job to do this presentation and talk with us. Thank you, everyone, for joining our live discussion. IT Showcase has live webinars scheduled every month on a variety of topics. We hope you'll join us again and bring your colleagues. You can find our upcoming webinar schedule as well as on-demand webinars and other content at Microsoft.com/ITShowcase. Thank you and have a great day.